Hey, Guy Powell here, and welcome to the next episode of the Backstory on the Shroud of Turin. If you haven't already done so, please visit guypowell.com and sign up for more episodes. I am the author of the new book, The Only Witness, a historical fiction tracing a possible history of the Shroud over the last two millennia. So today we're speaking with Dale Glover. And he's with the Real Seekers, and you can find him at realseekers.com. And he is a Christian apologetic, shroud researcher, and just a great person to talk to and get to know some of his knowledge and thinking. And today, with this very special presentation, he's going to be talking about how science, philosophy, and the shroud all kind of come together. And with that, Dale, so good to have you and welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much, Guy. This is great to be on your show. I think this is my third time being on the show. So, I'm really looking forward to this because obviously, in addition to being an apologist, I am a philosopher by training. So, I love philosophy, and I think it's really important, especially in a science-heavy field like studying the Shroud or Sindonology there.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly, the fun part about studying the Shroud is that just a single discipline in science is not enough. You really need to have a very broad capability to be able to not only study, nuclear with Bob Rucker, but chemical with Ray Rogers, and then textiles, and then you have to study art and so many things. And of course there's religion, underlying all of that. And it is truly amazing how important science and philosophy then come together as you're studying the Shroud.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it was Joe, our mutual friend Joe Marino, who posted up something. He found out there's over 100 academic disciplines, right? Theology, history, science, you name it kind of thing. Everyone seems to be involved in studying the Shroud. So, I guess it's, the heck with Joe Biden bringing the world together, it's the Shroud that's uniting everyone together. So.
Yeah, exactly. Although there are some naysayers as well out there, and it's
That's
you and me and many of the other videos that are out there that are trying to show that the shroud could actually be the true authentic burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And I think that that is also bringing the world together in a lot of different ways. There's many folks in Italy and Spain and Germany and France and England and of course the US that I've run to get run into, and there's folks even in Brazil and India, and
Yeah.
so there's a lot of stuff going on around the world concerning and understanding and researching the shroud.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I saw your video about the Shroud Academy, as you know already from my comment. But yeah, like I'm really impressed with what you and Joe and Otangelo are doing in terms of bringing Shroud research to like third world countries and stuff where like apologetics isn't kind of the norm. So like that's amazing. It's great to hear what's going on in India and other places like that. So I'm praying for for you guys' success there.
Yeah, thank you so much. We are, as a matter of fact, you mentioned the Shroud Academy. We are helping to promote Christianity through teaching of the Shroud. And in particular, we're about to do our first big presentation and training to about 70 different pastors in India so that they'll be able to then take that training and knowledge and understanding to their congregations and their flocks to hopefully help, further the word of Christ.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's wonderful. Like I said, I'm with you 100%. If anything I can do, if you want me, I don't know, I can promote if you guys do an event or something, but I'll be there to support in any way I can. So
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Well, you've been such a friend of mine and of the Shroud, of course, and everyone else. And you mentioned Joe, and I really appreciate the other day. You had us on, had me on, where we have put together a petition to demand a retraction or addendum to an article that is clearly false and has been certainly debunked, and it relates to the radiocarbon dating. And we're then trying to, get as many signatures as we can as we move forward and promote the the shroud and understanding of the shroud.
Absolutely. I've been promoting that. I was telling you before, I was on just on SJ Thomason's channel with Bob Rucker, and her audience, they've never heard of this, the neutron radiation and the vertically collimated radiation burst. So that was all new information, and I made sure to mention your petition and stuff like that, and people were all for it. So except one notable exception, our mutual friend Hugh Ferry, the Shroud Skeptic, he's not so pleased with it, but nonetheless, we're getting signatures, so that's great.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, and if you'd like to sign up for it, it's at guypowell.com/petition. And it's great to as much as he is he's a non-authenticist of the shroud, he though has helped all of us to be better shroud researchers, and we really, and his comments and his understanding and unfortunately his opinion going the other way as being a non-authenticist has, I think, has helped overall us authenticists to make our arguments even stronger. And with something like this petition, which now, will hopefully lead to the retraction of the article on the radiocarbon dating of the shroud in Nature magazine, is just one more step for us to do a much better job at promoting what we believe is good science and understanding of the shroud. And that brings us to your topic, which is going to be on science and philosophy. And I think you wanted to share some slides here as we go through today.
Absolutely, yeah. So let me bring that up. Okay, is that showing there?
Perfect. It
Perfect.
absolutely is. Thank you.
Yeah, so basically we have two topics today, but the first main one is I mentioned, look, Shroud Studies is predominantly a science-heavy field. There are a lot of scientists and engineers. On the other side, there's historians and stuff, but there's not a lot of philosophers. So I think that's where I kind of bring a unique perspective on that front. So I want to kind of look at what is the relationship between science and philosophy with respect to Shroud Studies. Awesome. So looking at Shroud Studies, obviously the main scientific studies started in the late 19th century and have gone through the 20th century and into the 21st centuries. And as I said, it's really been dominated by the scientists and the engineers. They've made the most important discoveries empirically about the shroud and its images and that sort of thing. And they've done that by applying the scientific method to come to a better understanding of these images. But I find that by contrast, very little professional philosophers and logicians have conducted detailed studies on the shroud evidence and applied that to shroud studies. And philosophers in this world, especially among unbelievers and that skeptics who are unbelievers, they're atheists and that, philosophers don't seem to be recognized as experts or respected. It's kind of we're just our heads are in the clouds, we're speculating, making stuff up, and educated guesswork and all this stuff. But actually, I wanted to say that philosophy is a necessary component here, and it is necessary specifically with respect to certain limitations or biases that I've detected among scientists who study the shroud at certain times. Specifically, how do we connect the dots and actually argue that the shroud images are miraculous? They are actually a supernatural miracle by God. Well, those words, supernatural and miracles, even on the pro-shroud side, among Christians, there's a kind of a hesitancy. They don't want to use those words. So I give a couple of quotes. So the famous stirp chemist, Dr. Ray Rogers, he has been quoted in his work saying, "The rigorous application of the scientific method requires that all the hypotheses that are proposed be tested equally. Hypotheses that involve miracles cannot be rejected categorically, but they are impossible to test experimentally. And Barry Schwartz was heavily influenced by Ray Rogers, so he has kind of the same sentiments there. Even Bob Rucker, who believes that the shroud images are miraculous, in one of my shows, said he prefers not to use the word miracle or supernatural. He doesn't think those are good terms because they lead to confusion and that sort of thing. So I've recognized that it's become kind of taboo to speak about the shroud images being miraculous or supernatural. And as a philosopher, I kind of want to kind of fight against that and say, no, these are, look, perf we're perfectly able as philosophers to go and use these words properly, as a rational agent and that sort of thing, right? We don't want to go down the slippery slope into scientism or naturalism. And that's kind of the fear. If we're too afraid to use these words, we might go down that way. So basically, let's find out a little bit, what is science proper? And in the first place, science, it comes from the Latin word scientia, which just means knowledge. So that's what science is. It's a way to gain knowledge. Believe it or not, originally in the 1600s, this was a domain or sub-discipline of philosophy. It was called natural philosophy back in the day. And today, science is kind of understood to be a specific field, or rather multiple fields of study related to the natural world and how that typically operates in accordance with natural laws. But it's important to note that science is it's what's called a first order discipline. So science is kind of a discipline that deals with descriptive features about the natural world, right? So it asks questions like, what is a covalent bond? Or what is it that makes an ecosystem stable? What is the nature of DNA? Or in shroud studies, are the shrouds bloodstains composed of paint, or are they composed of blood? These are kind of the first order questions that disciplines like history or science, that's what they deal with. But then there are a second order discipline, and that's where philosophy comes in. This is where we can study the actual first order disciplines themselves. So at the university, you'll never see a science of philosophy department, but there are departments, philosophy of science, philosophy of history or historiography, and so on and so forth. And it's because philosophy is a second order discipline. It's a normative discipline. It evaluates the assumptions, concepts, limitations, methodologies, of the first order disciplines themselves, and prescribes, what, in terms of science, it asks these second order questions. What is science? What qualifies as the proper scientific method, if any? Is there an external world out there? That's a pure philosophy question, right? My point is with all of this is that philosophers and not scientists themselves are the ones trained to ask and evaluate these higher order questions. So we play a crucial role here.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense too. It's kind of like, it's not just, like you said, it's not just, is it blood or paint on the shroud, or is it a covalent bond? But it's then, how you look at the science and how you look at the science itself, and that makes a lot of sense. So yeah, thanks for talking about that.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, it's important, like how do we interpret and use the data, the scientific data that we're getting to make philosophical conclusions and that sort of thing, right? So basically, just to explain, there are two fundamental positions in the philosophy of science. And there's the EPS versus the IPS. Great. What is that? What am I talking about there? Well, here's the problem as I see it. Since the 20th century, a lot of scientists tend to adopt what's called the internal philosophy of science position. This is basically where they say science is the god of all disciplines. It's science that dictates truth. All other disciplines, they just bow to science. It's a one-way street. They tell you, and there's nothing that other disciplines can inform scientists or science and stuff, right? So this is called what's called the internal philosophy of science. Science itself is just automatically justified. It's self-justified. it can't be questioned or evaluated on a higher level or anything like that. And I would say that, believe it or not, in the philosophy of science, among philosophers, this position is not really respected today, even though among scientists who are laymen as philosophers, they take this position. So someone like Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking, they would all go for this internal philosophy of science. But among philosophers, this position was really refuted in the early 20th century. Nobody really takes this position today. And I list a couple problems. First of all, reality just presents us with those higher order questions, right? Questions about science as a method, as a discipline in itself. So you're not, you're just ignoring certain questions as being irrelevant when we know that these questions actually exist and need to have answers. And it also reduces the higher normative discipline of philosophy to just being a mere descriptive one, which is what science deals with. And also it's question begging, right? Because they just assume that science can't be questioned and then it's justified. Just take it as a given and work from there. Well, as a philosopher and logician, that you can't do that. That's not a logical thing to do, right? So this is why most people, and what I think we should adopt, is the external philosophy of science position. So this represents the mainstream scholarship, at least in philosophy of science today. And it says that science in and of itself can and is an object of study. And in those kinds of contexts, other disciplines can be utilized to evaluate the scientific discipline. So philosophy or history of science, these other disciplines can inform what science is or answer certain higher order questions about science. And it's a two-way street, right? Science is used to inform us in philosophy, just like philosophy can be used to inform science. It's known as a complementary view, right? We both disciplines complement each other. They're mutually reinforcing towards providing knowledge, which is what Scientia was all about back in the 1600s. So, yeah, my main point here is that I think that the EPS view recognizes that philosophy is a normative discipline. It tells us what science ought to be, what ought to qualify as the proper scientific method, and how we ought to interpret our empirical scientific observations and data and make conclusions that go beyond science, such as arguing for a miracle or that the shroud images are miraculous. And just to give an example of how philosophy is used as a normative, higher order discipline and how scientific evidence can be used in a philosophical context. Here's one example with the famous cosmological argument, right, for the existence of God. So Dr. William Lane Craig, he's famous for his Kalam cosmological argument. And basically, he employs scientific evidence or data from the modern field of cosmology to argue that a being like God exists. And again, God is a supernatural being that the first moment of the Big Bang is a supernatural act because why there was no nature before nature existed in the universe, right? So obviously here, scientists don't have a problem with that, but you have this philosophical argument. Everything that begins to exist has an external cause in God. Premise two, well, the universe, all of nature began to exist. And then conclusion, therefore the universe has an external cause in God. Now, this is a philosophical argument, but scientific evidence is used to support the truth of the premises. What, for example, with premise two, why should we believe that the universe began to exist? Well, this is where we take into account the evidence from cosmology, such as the universe's thermodynamic properties, the cosmic redshift discovered in 1929, the fact the CMB radiation discovered in 1965. As well as from mathematics, right? We have the singularity theorems, the most important of which is the Bohr, Guth, and Vilenkin singularity theorem from 2003, which basically proves amazingly only one assumption. So long as the universe on average is in a state of expansion, cosmic expansion, then the universe absolutely must have began to exist. It's a proof, mathematical proof. So all of these things we can bring in to provide support for the truth of premise two. And that's the role that I see scientific evidence having, right? It's something that can be used as support for a philosophical argument that allows us to connect the dots and argue, in this case, for a supernatural being, God. And there's no problem with that sort of thing. Now, obviously, you'll have skeptics who'll say, what? But they'll debate the cosmological evidence and say, but actually, there are different ways to interpret that. There's the Hugh Fairies of the cosmology, right? And for example, you'll have to deal with, okay, great. Well, once we have the data, and then we propose, well, the best interpretation of that is that the universe actually began to exist, as premise two states. Well, you'll get this atheist saying, no, actually, the universe is still eternal, even with this data. And how do we explain it? Well, because there's an eternal steady state model. This was the very first eternal model proposed in 1948. And then that's where you apply the empirical data to rule out this hypothesis as being improbable. And you say, well, the best explanation is really the Big Bang model, positing that the universe did in fact begin to exist. And from that, my philosophical argument takes over, kind of thing.
As you're talking, I'd love to get your opinion. There's kind of two things. One is, does that mean that there are other universes? And then, of course, where did they come from? Number one. And then number two, what is also fascinating is that the universe, as we understand it today, has a whole bunch of different constants to it. Things like the speed of light, things like the Planck constant, and other things. And if this universe had been created with slightly different values for those constants, it's possible and probable that the universe would not still exist, so to speak. It wouldn't be here. So somehow those constants had to be, decided upon and not just given. Certainly, we wouldn't have done that. So therefore, if the universe was created, had an external cause, as you have in bullet one there, then those constants had to be part of it, for example, and then therefore there had to have been something that must have caused that to happen. Does that make sense, or am I following along where you're going?
So you're right that so in terms of the multiverse, that's a possibility. I personally don't believe in a multiverse scenario. I think those are improbable. Although my professor, my philosophy professor, is actually considered an expert in the Christian multiverse theory. He says that given Christian theism, that predicts that there would be a multiverse because the greatest conceivable being would create all of these various universes and that. So now, outside of that, believe it or not, you're talking about a totally different argument. And actually, you're smarter because the argument you're talking about is called the teleological argument, or the argument from the fine-tuning or design of the universe. And that relates better to the argument I give for the shroud. So I should have done that instead of the cosmological argument. But basically, that says that, look, we have the various constants of the universe that are incredibly fine-tuned for life. And this is from the same scientific evidence of cosmology, right? Where we're engaging in that descriptive discipline. And that could provide evidential support for a premise in the teleological argument from the fine-tuning of the universe. So you could have something like premise one, like, either the fine-tuning of the universe is either due to natural regularities, laws of nature, random chance, or design. And then you rule out it's not due to natural regularities and it's not due to random chance. Therefore, it must have been designed. Who's that designer? It's God, kind of thing. So that's how you would do a kind of a similar argument based on the data from fine-tuning. You've got it correctly, which exactly.
Okay. Thank
Perfect.
you.
No worries. So here's my application to the shroud. It can be the same thing. We can connect the dots to arguing for a miracle or a supernatural act of God to authenticate Jesus' death and by crucifixion and subsequent resurrection from the dead. And we can utilize all of that great scientific data to support one or more of the premises in a philosophical argument where we connect those dots. So even if you want to argue that the scientific discipline is limited to just studying the natural world, you can't, as a scientist doing science, argue for a miracle or su something supernatural. Let's take that as a granted, as a scientist. Yes, but you, as a philosopher, you can go beyond the limits of any sub-discipline, right? Because philosophy is the higher order discipline. So you could make a simple philosophical argument based on the shroud images, such as a design argument that I just gave, right? Premise one, either the shroud images were formed by natural regularities, the laws of nature, random chance, or intelligent design. And that's what Bill Dembski from the Discovery Institute calls the trichotomy rule. These are the only three choices. There is no fourth option, explanatory option for explaining the shroud images. Premise two, the shroud images were not formed through natural regularities or random chance. Obviously, you can see that's where we bring in some of the shroud scientific data when we've evaluated things like the painting hypothesis or the powder rubbing, the scorch. We've been able to scientifically rule those out, and that provides support that premise two is true. Premise three, if the shrouded images were formed by intelligent design, then either the designer was either a human artist or it was God. Obviously, that premise, when I was on your show last time, this premise is actually unsound because there could be more options. Remember, I mentioned maybe Satan made the shroud images or maybe aliens and stuff, but I'm just keeping it simple here, right? So either it's a human artist or it's God. And basically, premise four, we can rule out that a medieval human artist designed those images. Therefore, what's the remaining designer? Well, therefore, God exists, and he must have supernaturally or miraculously designed the shroud images. So yeah, there we go. That's how we can apply science in a philosophical argument that allows us to connect the dots and freely use words like miracle and supernatural. And there's no problem about artificial man-made limits about, well, science just, we've arbitrarily defined science as only dealing with the natural world. So by definition, you can't talk about supernatural events. No, but scientists can follow the scientific method as they see fit and then use that data. And then as a philosopher, apply that to connect the dots. Am I making sense or am I sounding totally nuts or?
No. It makes absolute sense because and obviously simplified, but your five bullets here in terms of what the different options might be in terms of how the shroud was formed, and then realizing that it wasn't natural regularity or a random chance. It wasn't a million monkeys sitting at typewriters typing out the works of Shakespeare. But instead, it was intelligent design, and therefore, if it was intelligent design, then there it had to have been created by God, and that's then that where that supernatural slash miracle comes in. That makes total sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And if people are interested, like when I was on your show the first time, when I described my minimal relevant features approach and I gave the criteria using specified complexity criteria, that's where I kind of gave the specific details. But this is kind of the basic format that argument is following, except that I not only rule out human artists, I rule out Satan, angel, everyone else other than God, I'm able to falsify them through the specification criterion, and that's how I say, well, it's God.
Yeah, makes sense.
So that's kind of my impassioned plea is, look, if you're a scientist and you want to, for strategic purposes, you're hesitant to use the word supernatural or miracle. Look, sometimes I don't use that with certain atheists and skeptics are hyper hostile towards that word, then I'm fine with using a God-designed event, and then I appeal to intelligent design criteria. That's what I argued in the first show I was on with you, Guy. But at the same time, we shouldn't be afraid of using the word supernatural or miracle when it's important to do so. I mean, we as Christians, we should believe there are miracles, there are events that go beyond the laws of nature. There's nothing to be ashamed of there and that sort of thing. So, yeah, apply it as a philosopher, and then there's no problem.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, wonderful.
All right, well, that's it on that subject there. So the next subject, any questions, I guess, before we.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And I like the simplicity with which you've put it together. You've got the three bullets in the first one, and then you've got the five in the second one. That I think they all make sense. Certainly you have somehow that image was made, and so far, and probably never we may understand what the mechanism was that made that image at some point in the near or distant future, but there had to have been something that then would have caused that. And I like this progression of the five steps here to get to this God designed and God, miraculously having generated the image in some fashion. So that makes it makes total sense.
Awesome. Perfect. All right, cool. So my next topic is really kind of changing gears. It's again based on philosophy a bit, but it's the total irrelevancy of the dating of the shroud. So this is kind of a claim that I make that's unique. I don't know of anyone who has agreed with it. You were a little hesitant yourself when I briefly mentioned it, but I basically argue that, hey, let's pretend for the sake of argument that the shroud is in fact medieval. Just for a second, let's pretend, okay, we do another carbon dating and Bob Rucker's hypothesis is wrong and it's not an invisible reweave and this thing really is medieval. I argue, who cares? The images, that argument I gave above still applies. All of the scientific evidence and data about the image and the argument related to how these images were formed is the same, whether it's a medieval object or whether it actually covered the historical Jesus. And I just want to, so this, the way I see it is that the skeptic is making a twofold positive claim. So number one, they're claiming the shroud is in fact medieval in origin. And two, given it's medieval in origin, this proves the images are not miraculous signs from God, that Christianity is true. And it's the skeptic who bears the burden of proof for establishing the truth of both of these claims. So essentially, I can put their argument in a simple three-step thing, right? So here's their philosophical argument of the shroud skeptic. There's premise one, if the shroud is provably medieval, or to accommodate Hugh and Bob, if the shroud is probably medieval, then the shroud images are not miraculous signs from God that Christianity is true. Then they have premise two. Well, guess what? The shroud is probably medieval. Therefore, the shroud images are not miraculous signs from God. And typically, the much of the debate is on premise two, right? Pro-shroud guys say, nope, it's premise two is false. The shroud is not probably medieval. We can prove it dates back centuries or link it to the historical Jesus. We've got the Frey Codex, the Sudarium, all of that great stuff. And on the other side, oh, I thought you were going to say something. On the other side, Hugh Ferry will bring up the carbon dating or the 1389 Darcy Memorandum. And that's where the debate is usually in terms of shroud studies. But I want to say, look, even if we, let's just grant premise two, I also question the shroud skeptics on premise one. Why should I believe premise one? If the shroud is probably medieval, then so what? Why should I believe that means the shroud images are not miraculous signs from God? And on that front, the shroud skeptic, I don't think they have any good reasons for thinking that premise one is true. So let's just take a look at some of their attempts at providing reasons to think that, yeah, if the shroud is medieval, then it's not miraculous. The images are not supernatural or miracles from God. So the first one is that they'll say, well, a medieval miracle from God is implausible, just in and of itself. And my response to that is that, well, look, first of all, God is an omnipotent being. He's a maximally great being. He's able to do miraculous signs at any time in human history, and it's equally plausible at all times, right? So long as he's achieving his providential goals, I don't see why that would be a problem. And think about it in terms of, I know, miracle claims today. Many Christians believe that there are Mary sightings or Jesus visions. You know, Muslims have Jesus visions, such as Nabil Qureshi, and this is why he came to faith in Christ as a Muslim. Or there are supernatural miracle healings and double-blind prayer experiments. And nobody bats an eye. Nobody said, oh my God, well, this took place in the year 2000. It can't be a miracle. No, only miracles only take place in 30 AD or between Jesus' ministry. That's the only time, right? Or back in biblical days. No, God, there's nothing about time that restricts God's power. He can do a miracle at any time for his own reasons. If he's got a goal, he can do it. That requires a miracle, he can do it. Okay, so the second reason that skeptics say argue for premise one is they'll say, but a medieval miracle shroud is totally ad hoc as a historical hypothesis. Like submitting that as a historical hypothesis, that's very ad hoc. It's a non-evidenced assumption. Well, my response is, look, it is true that it is ad hoc. If I were submitting this as a historical hypothesis, a positive claim in my own right. But remember that burden of proof. As a philosopher, it's the skeptic who has to prove their premise one is true. They're making the claim, not me. I'm just saying, but what if God did a miraculous copy of the shroud, proving that Jesus and Christianity is true in the medieval period? What you have to prove that God didn't do that or couldn't do that or something like that. So I'm not submitting this as a positive claim. In point of fact, I don't believe that the shroud is medieval. I think that it did cover the historical Jesus, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not making a claim. Only the shroud skeptic is. So therefore, it's not ad hoc.
Yeah, no, sorry. I was just agreeing with what you're saying, and I think that that then is a hard argument for a non-authenticist, or I guess a medievalist, to argue against. How can they, if the shroud was created and was a miracle in medieval times, then they can't prove that it's otherwise. I mean, they can't say that it's a painting, a die, a scorch, or whatever. So it could absolutely be a medieval miracle. So I like your arguments there.
Exactly. And what's amazing is when I had on my show, the ultimate shroud skeptic, Hugh Ferry, he agreed with this. And he said, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, maybe it is a medieval miracle, or it's a copy of, Jesus' actual burial shroud, but it's a miraculous copy. So the point here is that the scientific evidence, if you think that the scientific evidence from STIRP about those images warrants the conclusion that those images are miraculous and were created by God, that remains the same regardless of what date those images were created on that shroud cloth. It's totally irrelevant. Okay, here's a third thing. So this is something I heard from a lot of atheists on SNS. Oh, Dale, you're just biased. This is fallacious reasoning, right? You're engaging in special pleading and moving the goalposts. And my response is, first of all, no, I'm not. As Gary Habermas will attest through our years of discussion before I was ever a Christian. I always asserted this, that I didn't care about the dating of the shroud images. I just cared about, are they miraculous or not? And remember, it's in terms of moving the goalposts, no, because my standard was always, what does the science suggest about the nature of the images, and what can I conclude? Miracle or no miracle on that front. It was never about, oh, but when does the shroud date from? So I never had the goalposts in that position ever. And yeah, Gary Habermas can attest to this because we've had debates and discussions about this one-on-one over years. Is it special pleading? Am I applying standards or principles or rules in an ad hoc basis only towards the shroud that I wouldn't apply elsewhere? No, because I apply this for any and all miracles. For example, I'm famous for I almost converted to Islam in 2017 based on one of the five categories of numerical miracle patterns in the Quran. Now, these numerical patterns only exist in the 1924 Egyptian version of the Arabic Quran. They don't exist in any other translation. There are at least two others that exist in the modern day, and they don't exist in any of the Quranic manuscripts that we have dating back through the centuries, right? So these numerical patterns only exist, so far as we know, in a Quran text that existed as of 1924. But I still considered, okay, all that matters is, can we prove that these numerical patterns are miraculous or not in nature? And obviously, in the end, I concluded that they're not, that I think that random chance explains them. And again, I applied specified complexity or intelligent design criteria to evaluate that. But the point is, the dating was totally irrelevant to me. I didn't care if it was the original Quran by Muhammad or if it was the 1924 version. If we have evidence proving there's a miracle in this text, regardless of the date, I'm going to follow that evidence. So I'm not special pleading here. Okay, so another more substantive thing that someone might put in to warrant premise one is the theological doctrines. They might argue, well, according to the Bible, divinely inspired scripture says that cessationism is true and not continuationism. The notion that miracle, supernatural miracles, God stopped, he ceased doing that after the completion of the New Testament writings. So therefore, a medieval thing is centuries after the New Testament was written. Therefore, you couldn't claim the shroud as a medieval miracle because he doesn't do miracles in the medieval period for whatever reason. Now, my simple reply to this is that, well, cessationism, unfortunately, is not, or fortunately, is not true. It's not biblically supported. And in fact, we have tons of evidence suggesting otherwise from miracle healings, such as Dr. Craig Keener and Michael Brown. They've done debates. So I'll just play a quick 5-minute clip from Dr. Michael Brown responding to this cessationism claim. Here we
Well,
go.
while you're doing that, I love your picture here on in Jerusalem, and what an iconic image, and just amazing. I'm very jealous. I haven't been to Jerusalem yet, but it's my wife and I are definitely looking at doing that. So it's some place you just have to go to, that's for sure.
Israel was amazing. Jerusalem, believe it or not, my favorite place was Tel Aviv, though. I just loved the beach and like the Mediterranean Sea and stuff like that, and just thinking about Jaffa, which was up the road and stuff like that. So,
Yeah, fantastic.
and you're hearing it.
Yep, hearing it
Personally
and responding.
concluded after
Yep.
reading the Bible that spiritual gifts have ceased. Sometimes reinforce their biblical view by asking, if the spiritual gifts are spread out among the body and not everybody receives the same gifts necessarily, why is it that almost everyone seems to have the gifts that are the most easily faked, while no one is walking around healing the blind and raising the dead? I'm not talking about a prayer of faith for divine healing that anyone can do. I'm talking about someone who has specifically received the gift of healing.
Right. So the answer to that is it's an entirely false premise. First, there are many prophetic words that are totally supernatural, that have no possible human explanation, that can't be faked, that have brought people to repentance in, shocking ways, tears of awe because of God. So, why does that happen? But Craig Keener, in his scholarly 2-volume work on miracles, after looking at documentation and testimonies, his estimate is that at least 200 million people on the planet are eyewitnesses to miracles, healings, miracles, etc. So there are accounts of the dead being raised. One of my best friends in the world, my best friend in India, Yesupadam, his wife Padmini died of brain cancer. It had spread down her spine. She was crippled. She was pronounced dead in the hospital in Visakhapatnam. They showed me the hospital, and less than 15 minutes later, she sat up, healed, got out of bed, started jumping up and down to the shock of the hospital. I mean, they had the sheet over her head the whole bit. And I met her. She lived a couple years after that and then went to be with the Lord. One of our grads for our ministry school, Dan Kalenda, who's taken over Reinhard Bonnke's preaching around the world for Christ for All Nations, he sent out a praise report one night that three kids in the same family, three kids who were all blind, were instantly healed in one of the meetings. And this happens all the time. So the fact is, God is doing this. Heidi Baker in Mozambique, people came to, because they've had a special gift for blind eyes opening and deaf hearing. So scientists came over to test and verified. I don't know if it's been published yet in the medical report. I was told it was going to be. Verified the healings of the deaf with scientific data. So God is doing it. So if you want to use the argument of experience, the fact is it is happening. And even the idea that it ceased in history, Augustine in the 4th century had written off healing and said it didn't happen anymore until in a 2-year period they documented 70 miracles and he had to change his theology based on what he experienced. So the word's clear on it. The word never says that it ceases. And therefore, we embrace what he's doing. And if we don't see it, we say something's missing.
So that's my response. The cessationism just isn't true biblically or even in history. We've got a lot of evidence for it, and there's nothing in the Bible that rules that out. A fifth attempt of these...
Yeah, and just as an aside, too, I don't know about you, but you know, there's this thing called the Holy Fire, which takes place, you know, once a year based on the prayers that are the praying that's done by certainly the patriarchs in Jerusalem on Easter, on Orthodox Easter, and then amongst the masses as well. And that certainly is seems to be a, you know, a miracle that is brought on by, you know, through prayer. And so that happens every year. It's pretty consistent, or seems to be pretty consistent. And so, you know, this cessationism is, you know, definitely not true. Just from, you know, there's another example of why that would not be true.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. Yep. I think it's clear the biblical position is the continuationism position. So, yeah, the spiritual, supernatural miracles continue to happen even after the completion of the New Testament. All right, cool. So another thing that a skeptic might do is they'll say, but there's a lack of sufficient attachment. Like, how are you attaching this supposedly miraculous images to mean that it's authenticating Jesus and the Jesus of Christianity? And remember, that's where the first time I was on your show, where I was talking about the presence of specified complexity criteria as saying that it's an intelligently designed image. And what's the specified purpose or teleos, the reason why God, the goal for why God created those miraculous shroud images in the medieval period? It would be to authenticate Christianity. And we know that from the contextual indicators on the shroud. I mean, even if you're a shroud skeptic and you think the shroud's fake, it's obvious that this shroud is depicting the Jesus of the Gospels. I mean, all the scourge wounds, the unique wounds only Jesus had in human history. No other person had the crown of thorns or the blood spear in the side with the blood and water flowing out, and was also crucified, the wounds of the crucifixion. Everyone knows this is depicting Jesus, or meant to depict Jesus of the Christian Gospels. And that's enough for the specification. Whether the shroud actually covered the historical Jesus or not, it doesn't matter. It's sufficiently attached because the images are attesting on and miraculously authenticating the death of Jesus by crucifixion and his treatment. And the fact it's implying the resurrection of Jesus because the body miraculously left the shroud, leaving behind those miraculous images before decomposition liquids could accumulate on that cloth. And that implies the truth of the resurrection. These are the essential Christian gospel message there. An example I give to illustrate why the dating doesn't matter here. Think of a modern painting, just a picture portraying the Jesus of the Christian Gospels, the exact same thing as depicted on the shroud images, right? Again, we know it's a painting, but we know that this painting was painted in the year 2000. We know the artist personally. And okay, great. And then let's say one day you're praying to God to give you a sign that Christianity is true. And all of a sudden, poof, God transforms that painting into a miraculous image on a burial shroud. It has all the same properties that Stirp discovered related to the shroud images. But again, this, you know, because you are an eyewitness, that this is originally, this was just a normal painting that was painted in the year 2000. And God has transformed that painting for whatever reason into a miraculous image that has all the same features as the shroud images. Would you really reject that miracle and say, well, no, that's not authenticating Christianity. I don't know who that's meant to authenticate or portray. Maybe, that's a proof for Allah or the Hindu god or something. No, you can tell by the fact from the contextual indicators of the image that it's meant to be Jesus. And that combined with the fact we can prove that it was that the images have been miraculously transformed, that that's an authentication of the Christian gospel and Jesus of the gospels. Well, it's the same with the shroud. Even if it's a medieval thing that was created, and poof, God created those images in the medieval era, the fact we can prove a miracle from the scientific stirp evidence in terms of the nature of the images, plus the contextual indicators authenticating this is depicting Jesus of the Gospels, that's enough for a sufficient attachment. Is that making sense, Guy, or?
Yeah, no, it is, and I like your point that you could have, if you had a medieval miracle making the shroud, who's to say that you couldn't have another shroud image depicted miraculously, whether it's 1686 or 1986 or 2086. So yeah, I like that. That makes a lot of sense.
Awesome. Yeah, exactly. So, all right, cool. So here's the last attempt, the last desperate attempt of the shroud skeptic to establish the truth of premise one. And I have to admit, this is the most weighty one. So they'll argue, but look, if God did this medieval miracle creating the shroud images, that would make God a deceiver, a liar, a trickster in some way. And theologically, the Christian God is not a deceiver. He's not a liar. So it couldn't be, the Christian God couldn't have created medieval, miraculous shroud images because it leads to this confusion of people, right? They think it really is Jesus's historical burial shroud. Certainly, me and Guy believe that, based on the evidence. And if that's not true and it is a medieval miracle, me and Guy have been fooled. You've been tricked by God. He's doesn't this make him an immoral liar in some way? Now, I have a series of responses here. So my first response is that actually the contextual indicators don't necessarily imply this, right? It's not like the Shroud of Turin comes with a little label saying made in 30 AD. God is not directly lying, right? It's us as human beings. We are inferring based on certain clues and making an inference that it dated the historical Jesus. But there are also indications that maybe it's not the historical burial shroud, right? So, for example, shroud skeptics Hugh Ferry have said, and Bob Rucker has confirmed that, as well as Ada Grossi, who's a textile expert and archaeologist there, that the shroud itself isn't a burial shroud. It's not a proper burial shroud that would have been used. It's more akin to a tablecloth that pro shroud guys say were used in the temple and were discarded for some reason, and therefore Joseph of Arimathea acquired it. And maybe in his haste to bury Jesus, they used this cloth because that's the only thing they had available, and they were in a rush to get Jesus in the tomb before sundown. But there is that's look, this isn't a proper first century burial shroud, according to shroud skeptics and even pro shroud archaeologists. They say this looks like some kind of table or temple cloth or something like that. So therefore God's not tricking us. He gave us a clue right there that this is a medieval miracle, perhaps. Secondly, even without that, no, there's nothing on or about the miraculous nature of the shroud images in and of themselves that entails belief that it can sit that it covered the historical Jesus, right? The fact that it's the images are three-dimensional or they're vertically collimated or they're superficial, and that we conclude that based on all these features, the only mechanism that could have made these images must have been a supernatural miracle of God. Nothing in and of itself about those facts entails, well, it must have covered the historical Jesus, right? That's an inference that some people are making. And I'm saying that that's a false inference to make. Instead, you should look at the separate category of the historical evidences. And do you think, based on those, all those evidential factors, the carbon dating, the Prey Codex, the other historical indications about the Shroud Man that relate to its historical authenticity, you can conclude that it covered Jesus on that basis, but that's a separate category of evidence. Nothing related to the science of the images in and of itself says, oh, this must have covered the historical Jesus, versus, no, it's a medieval miracle authenticating what happened to Jesus in 30 AD. Remember, there's no little label that said made in 30 AD on the shroud, right? And this is based on flawed reasoning. And I find that a lot of atheists, they arrogantly like to judge God as a deceiver in many ways. So if you're a Christian listening to this and you're hesitant, I know Teddy Pappas hates my argument about the irrelevancy from the dating. And I've heard from several people telling me don't make this, but I think it's because they think it makes God a deceiver, but it's not. Because think of atheists. They constantly make this deceptive concealment of nature argument against God, right? So, for example, when we see starlight, when we see the stars in the sky, for millennia, human beings have just assumed, right? It didn't come with a label saying, hey, you're seeing us as we look today. No, we inferred that as human beings, fallible human beings, we just assumed, oh, that star, that galaxy that looks like a star to me, that's how it must appear right now, because when I observe things here on Earth, that's the current time. It wasn't until the 20th century that we learned scientifically that actually when we observe the starlight, we're observing that star as it looked billions of years ago in the past, because it takes light, which travels at a constant speed, a finite speed, time to arrive to our eyeballs. Now, atheists are going to say, well, that makes God deceiving. He's tricking us. But are you, as a Christian, are you really going to say, well, yeah, fine, I don't believe in God. He's a liar. He lied to me about those stars. He made me believe that those stars exist just as I see them today, as opposed to looking like that billions of years ago. No, that's hubris. That's arrogance. We would never think that God's a deceiver because of something like that. That's the problem, is our false assumptions as human beings, right? Or same with quantum physics. I mean, wasn't until the early 20th century that we started learning about that, all that weirdness. And that, in some ways, goes against our common sense interpretations of the laws of physics and stuff like that. Are you a Christian who believes in quantum physics? Are you going to disbelieve in God now because he's a liar? He deceived us about the true nature of subatomic particles all this time? Or relativity theory, right? So you could go on and on. If you want to make this kind of deceptive concealment type argument, I just find it's very assumptive. And the fault really lies with us as human beings. And I argue it's the same argument with the Shroud of Turin. There's no label. It's our assumption that, well, if it's miraculously depicting Jesus, it must have actually covered the historical Jesus. That's an assumption. Just like we assumed that the distant starlight, those stars appear today as we see them with our eyeballs, as opposed to showing us what they looked like billions of years ago, right? And then response three, even if God did use a real first century burial cloth to imprint his miraculous medieval images rather than something else, there may have been, I'm saying, why would God have done a medieval miracle? So this is what response three is about. Why wouldn't he have done it at the time of Jesus? Wouldn't that have made more sense? It certainly seems simpler to most people. It's the natural assumption, right? And this is where I get into Molinism, right? In God's middle knowledge and foreknowledge, he knows what every free creature would freely choose to do in every single set of circumstances. And on that basis, what is God's main goal? He wants to save as many free will creatures as possible. And given God's middle knowledge, his knowledge of what free creatures would freely choose to do if in scenario X versus scenario Y, in his providence, he set up the world and he knew that a medieval miracle would lead to the outcome of saving more free will creatures. I can't prove that, But I think that biblically speaking, that makes the most sense because we can prove that that is God's ultimate goal, to save as many free will creatures as possible, to live in an eternally loving relationship with them. And I think given that we can prove God miraculously designed those shroud images, and those are images that are attached to the truth of the Christian gospels, Jesus of the Christian gospels, then that seems to be authenticating the Christian gospel message of salvation, that we too will rise again through belief in Jesus, through faith in Jesus as our Lord and Savior. And that's my argument, is that, well, why medieval? I mean, well, why did Jesus come in 30 AD? Who knows? God in his providence knew that was the proper time and place for each event that happens in human history, right? So that's my argument. Nobody questions why God sent Jesus, or why did Jesus become incarnate in and around 6 BC? Why not 5 BC, God? Why not 300 BC? Why did you pick that date? Well, he knows best. He's omniscient. He in his providence knows what's best. And if the shroud is indeed a medieval miracle, then I trust God. I know that he in his providence had a reason, and he knew that was the right time to do it. Maybe that was the best time to preserve it or something like that. So yeah, that's my case.
Well, I like the last argument as well, because why did God choose Jesus to be born whenever it was, 6 BC, 4 BC, or why did he choose, or in your example, why couldn't he have chosen to have done this miracle in medieval times? And and if, first of all, God is omniscient, omnipotent, and and is the I am, then and I exist, and I he existed throughout all eternity, then why couldn't he have done anything? So that that's kind of like the whole premise as well, is that he is omniscient, he can and omnipotent, he can do what and when and why he wants to do things, and it's not really we may never ever figure that out. So that that makes absolute sense. Yeah, very
Awesome.
interesting.
I converted you. Awesome. So that's great then. Yeah, 'cause I remember our first time, you're like, well, I'm a little iffy, but I think I finally got you there this time. So but
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one thing that I like, and when we talk, you have a, I like the, if this, then that, kind of a,
the
a way of
conditionals.
arguing, and that makes things, very clear, and it also gives good argumentation, against, against non-authenticists on the shroud side, but also atheists and non-Christians as well, to help to argue why we believe in Christ, why we believe God is what we believe he is, and I think that that's why what you do and how you do it, I find to be very very fascinating and very educational. So thank you for all of that.
No problem. My pleasure. Look, at the end of the day, the shroud skeptics don't give us a break. They question every little claim that we make. So I'm not going to give them a pass, even on this claim. We can't just assume that, well, if the shroud's medieval, that therefore it's game over. It's not a miracle. Why should I grant that, skeptic? Prove You have to prove that to me, right? So yeah.
Well, and I like the point that and I think you've made it as well, is that quite often, well, you're a Christian, you're biased. And the same thing applies to an atheist. Well, you're an atheist, you're biased.
Exactly.
So how do you come to a language that makes sense, that is believable, and then can take a smart person like Hugh Farry, if as a non-authenticist, or maybe an atheist, and be able to then really say, well, if this is true and this is true, then therefore that is true. And that really helps, I think, the whole argumentation, and it definitely helps to just show that what we're doing makes sense, and that the shroud is You know, as we believe, is it is the authentic burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And to your point, you know, does the date really matter? Well, you know, up until today, I would have said, yes, the date matters. But I do like your argument that says, well, why couldn't it have been a miracle, a medieval miracle?
Exactly.
I was watching a video with Atangelo Grasso and another gentleman who was an atheist. And, you know, and I was kind of surprised that of the arguments that were being made. And, you know, and quite often, you know, the assumptions behind the arguments that were made by the atheists were just, you know, just totally wrong. And, you know, and then unfortunately, you end to some extent, you kind of end up arguing facts and saying, no, the sky is not blue, it's green or yellow or red. And, you know, but nevertheless, if you know, if you believe in a certain number of facts and to your methodology as if this, then that, then, you know, then that I think can get past many, many arguments that you'll hear atheists, you know, espouse.
Absolutely. Yeah. The use of conditionals is something that philosophers do all the time. They're the most popular forms of argument, right? And in fact, scientists use this all the time in the field of science. The principle of falsification is predicated upon conditional statements, those if-then statements, right? So they say, if my hypothesis is true, if relativity theory is true, then I predict that we will see, what is it they discovered, where the light bending, the gravitational waves or something like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, the gravitational lensing around galaxies and heavy objects, absolutely.
Exactly. So yeah, if you look out there and you have the opportunity and you don't observe that, well, then you know your hypothesis is false. This is in science, it's called the principle of falsification. That is directly based on philosophical argumentation called modus tollens, or denying the consequent. And that's a logical philosophical argument that utilizes an if-then statement, right? If my hypothesis is true, then we will observe X, Y, or Z. We don't observe X, Y, or Z, therefore my hypothesis is false. So right. That's just another beautiful way of, you know, philosophy is where it's at, guys. No, I'm just joking. Scientists is helpful too.
You just had to put that little dig in there, huh?
I expose my bias a little bit, but yeah.
That's right. Oh, man, I tell you, how funny. Well, Dale, very good. I really appreciate it. And thanks for coming on, and thanks for being a supporter of our petition, by the way, guypowell.com/petition. And then, of course, Dale, where can folks read and find out more information about you and some of the things that you've done?
Yeah, so I have a YouTube channel, Real Seekers, plural with an S, and that gets you to my YouTube channel with all my shows, where you can, you know, I also have a Shroud Wars series where I bring on experts like Mr. Powell here himself, and others to debate the shroud and the evidence, but a whole host of topics: philosophy of religion, the existence of God, abortion, you name it, I address it on my channel. I also have a blog, which is RealSeeker singular ministries.wordpress.com, and that's where I post up my blogs and I provide scholarly sources. So you can go beyond what I'm just saying or what my guests are saying and research for yourself. Now, one thing that I haven't set up yet, but I'm in the progress of doing it, is I've been hesitant about asking people for money and stuff like that. So I've never set that up, but I am at a point now where I'm starting to have to. So I've set up a PayPal. I guess I'll post up the link. I think it's the PayPal link /RealSeekers. And I'm also in the progress of doing a Patreon with three tiers. So the first tier, you know, if you just want to help me out, I think it's like $5 or something, and it's just my Real Seekers content from YouTube. Then I have a middle tier, which is Real Seekers Plus, and I'll be doing like bonus stuff, like, you know, reaction or review videos to some content and stuff like that. And then the last one was a suggestion from my friend Tyler Fowler, it's Real Seekers Beyond. So it's not related to Christian apologetics, because I think that my apologetics material should always be available for free. And, you know, you can pay me on Patreon if you want to support me, but either way, you can get it on YouTube for free. But the Real Seekers Beyond thing will be exclusive to Patreon, and that's where I'm going to be teaching secular philosophy courses that I've taught or taken as a master's student. So, yeah, that again, that's at the Patreon website /Real Seekers, and hopefully I'll have that published this week. But that's everything on me.
Well, fantastic. That's really phenomenal. So Real Seekers, and then you said paypal.com/Real Seekers. In any case, I'm sure you'll have them on your website and on your YouTube channel. And when you're ready, if you'd like, you know, come back and we can talk about that and all the good work that you're doing. And certainly, as both of us, you know, do various things in promoting the Shroud and promoting Christianity, that, you know, sometimes it does take some money to help support that ministry. And so definitely wish you all the success with that, and, you know, do everything I can to help support you there.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Dale, thank you so much again. And to the audience, thank you so much. And obviously, stay tuned for many other videos in this series of the Backstory on the Shroud of Turin. And if you'd like, please visit guypowell.com and sign up for more episodes. But definitely, please go to guypowell.com/petition/petition and sign the petition about the Nature magazine article that we're trying to have retracted. Thank you so much.